Hey everyone, and welcome to The Image Doctors. This is episode number 58 for January 24th, 2008. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And thanks again for joining us on our production brought to you by Nikonians Podcasts.
Yep. And it's been a while since we've recorded, probably not something apparent to people, but I was out the last few weeks on a trip, which we'll talk about in a minute. And so
you had fun. You were on vacation.
Yeah.
I was at work.
Yeah, sorry.
But a lot of good stuff today. So we're going to talk about Rick's trip to Ecuador and the Galapagos.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll probably be the bulk of this episode, which is just, I'm anxious to hear about how that went myself.
Yeah, and we'll squeeze in, you know, a fair amount of discussion regarding using the D3 and the D300 down there. So we'll kind of continue the topics we've already done of, you know, regarding those two cameras.
Because you brought both of those cameras.
Yeah,
right?
I did.
Okay.
And so we'll talk about learning experiences, some fine-tuning I've been doing that you've been doing, all that kind of junk.
And then we're going to follow up with our discussion, our mini review of the Gitso travel tripod that we talked about in the last episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because you brought it with you and you actually
right.
now got to use it. And in conjunction with that, we're going to talk about small ball heads that you could use with a travel tripod.
Right.
There's a couple different options out there on the market.
Right.
And then, of course, we're going to have our photo prescription that we try to bring you every episode.
Yep. So that should be a pretty full episode, I would say.
I hope so.
Yep.
We seem to never run out of stuff to talk about.
No.
Well, you went to the Galapagos, which makes me immediately jealous of you because it's one of those places that is, as a someone who did their schooling in biology, it's a very cool place to go.
Yeah,
it's on my list.
It's utterly awesome.
Even if it weren't for photography, I'd want to go there.
Yeah, quite honestly, it was a place that I never thought I'd get to go to. It was just a set of circumstances that made it possible. And my wife suggested it, which is, you know, a bonus.
There you go.
No guilt.
Now you're really... You hit the double bonus with that one.
Yeah. So just a little bit about the Galapagos and Ecuador and our trip and all that kind of stuff first before we start talking about the equipment. The Galapagos Islands, if you're not familiar with them, are actually part of Ecuador. And a significant portion of the islands are in the Galapagos National Park. It's administered by the Ecuadorian government. And what we did to get down there, we were flying out of Denver, since that's pretty close by where we live, not too far away, and flew down to Quito, Ecuador. We ended up spending about 3 nights there first. And Quito, if you're not familiar with it, is, you know, big modern city, almost 1.5 million people or so. It's in a kind of a narrow mountainous valley. So it's very long and kind of narrow. And it's at high altitude. It's... something like 2,600 meters or so, you know, so just right
so
around
pretty
9,
comparable
000,
to
over 9,000
yeah,
feet.
Yeah, that's more than what we're at up
yeah,
here
probably
in Colorado.
A little bit low on my meters, I think, there. So pretty high altitude and very hilly around the city. There are some volcanoes close by. Really interesting in a lot of respects. You see the clouds swirling around the hills all the time. You definitely, at least while we were down there, both before the Galapagos and after, you got that sense of city in the clouds. It's pretty cool. And Quito's got a very nice colonial area that's fairly large in size with, you know, very interesting architecture in the buildings, nice public squares, cathedrals, all that kind of stuff, an interesting history. So it was a modern city in general, but very nice, I would say. And
how long did it take you to get down there?
Not bad. We flew from Denver to Houston, Houston to Quito, and it's not painful. We weren't jumping a huge number of time zones. It's in the Eastern time zone.
Okay.
So only 2 hours ahead of where we're at in Colorado.
Yeah, South America confuses me because it's farther east than you think it is.
It is.
You don't think of it that way, but it does extend a lot farther east.
If you look
east.
At a map, it's absolutely the case.
So because the Galapagos Islands are in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
And for you geography majors out there, that's
right
or not.
Right.
And that's where you're going to be going down
but
to.
Key thing for, you know, our listeners in North America, it's an easy place to get to. And if you're in South America, you know, really easy to get to.
That's right.
And not bad from Europe either. So nice destination. We also went to some outlying towns, went to some markets and things like that. So we saw an Ecuadorian equivalent of Crater Lake, which was pretty cool, up in the mountains. and really enjoyed those first few days. And then we got back to Quito and flew out of the airport there very early in the morning. I think we had a 7 o'clock flight that took us to the Galapagos via another town in Ecuador, Guayaquil. And that's just a common, I think that's pretty much the place you have to go through in order to get the Galapagos. I'm not positive of that, but all the flights seem to be going through Guayaquil. And we landed in the Galapagos, and it's actually a World War II vintage airfield in its own island. There's just an airfield and a little harbor for the boats. The tour company that we were with, a company called Eco Ventura, we'll put their website on the show notes page. Excellent company, by the way. I absolutely recommend them. Very well organized, professional, and everything. Picked us up at the airport, and we went on our boat, and it was a small boat, you know, so don't think about some big cruise ship or something like that. That's not what we were on. There were only a total of 20 passengers on it, about 10 cabins. It was very nice, very comfortable. You know, they had good food and everything, but it wasn't this huge swarm of people. And they actually had two naturalist guides on the boat in addition to the rest of the crew. So, you know, when we stopped at locations, which we did, you know, multiple times every day, we went out in groups of about 10 or so. So not, again, a huge swarm of people that you were with. And all the other passengers were very nice and very easy to get along to, similar interests.
Now, I'm guessing if you go down to the Galapagos, correct me if I'm wrong, mm-hmm. but you're pretty much, you need to be on some sort of guided tour of some sort because you can't just go there.
Well, you can go to the Galapagos, no problem. And you know, one of the... I know you that know this isn't the case, but one of the big myths about the Galapagos is that it's completely isolated, unpopulated. That's not true. There are towns, there are people, they're just in certain places on a subset of the islands. For example, the biggest town on Santa Cruz Island has over 15,000 people in it. So you go there, there are hotels, there are restaurants, there are shops.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's a pretty nice little town, actually.
It's just not the kind of place you'd think where you just sort of show up and rent a car.
No, you probably wouldn't do that. I think you could on that island and drive yourself around. But what you could do if you chose to is fly there and then do day trips out of there. There are outfits that do that. What we did is the different option of staying on the boat mm-hmm. and having the boat take us around all the islands, and we never had to take our stuff on or off, and it was a great way to do it.
Yeah, you only preferable if you unpack one time.
Right, right.
That's a good thing.
In the process of 7 nights on the boat, which is how long we were on it, we circled around the archipelago and hit probably the majority of the big islands, you know, the vast majority. There was really only one slightly larger island that we didn't hit, a couple little tiny ones that are well outside the main part of the island chain that we didn't go to, but all the others we did. So we went to a bunch, and I'll tell you, it really is impressive. You know, the very first stop that we had, you know, they have Zodiac kind of rafts. They're called pongas there, that where they take you in, you know, motorized rubber raft kind of thing that'll hold 10 or 12 people. And depending on where you're going, you could either have a wet landing where you land in the surf, you have to jump out, you know, into the water, or you in some places have a dry landing where you end up on rock, or there were a couple places where they had a little dock kind of thing, but not very many. So you hop off and then you're out there amongst the wildlife. And you know, it's the wildlife there is just amazingly tolerant of people and everything else. You literally could go up to a sea lion or a bird and just thump it on the nose, you know, if you chose.
Not recommended.
You don't do that, but no kidding, you could do that. It's bizarre at first, and the birds and the marine iguanas and the sea lions, et cetera, are just all over the place, saturated. It's not like you have to go out looking for things. They're just right there. You have to avoid tripping over them. Literally. Literally. So we were out there, you know, multiple times each day going around through different bird colonies, sea lion colonies, et cetera, photographing and hiking around. And it really is just a cool place. The islands vary from being, you know, just lush with vegetation, you know, just the typical tropical paradise kind of thing, like Santa Cruz Island was, to looking just like the moon.
You know? Yeah, and these are volcanic islands.
Right.
So the newer ones aren't going to have nearly as much vegetation on them. Because it hasn't had enough time to be populated with
right.
plants.
And they vary a little bit, too, with how pristine they are. One of the islands that we went to, Fernandina, was very pristine. Islands like Santa Cruz, you know, again, have towns on them and more introduced species have creeped in there, but still really great. And of course, you have the giant tortoises and the snorkeling is fantastic. You definitely want to plan on doing that. You know, we were snorkeling with sea lions. I mean, they were a foot away from us, coming up to us. You know, they were poking some people in their mask.
Wow.
You know, just playing around with them. Sea turtles, sharks.
So if you have an underwater housing for your camera.
Well, I think we'll skip this topic next time, this time, but maybe talk about it in the future. I actually took my little point-and-shoot camera, which is a Canon G9. I know, horrible that I bought a Canon, but...
All right, that's it. You're off the show.
All right. It's very good. I like it, and I have an underwater housing for it. They're not that expensive. So I took that with me, and I did do some shots, but we'll talk about that
that's
a different
cool.
time. Different topic. So,
but I mean, the point of your vacation was a vacation.
Yeah.
More than
it was a family trip.
It happened to be a particularly photogenic area.
Right.
So hence all the extra fun time. You know, you didn't spend every day just behind the camera.
Nope.
Which is a good thing.
And like we've talked about before, when you're doing a family trip, you have to be sensitive to others. And in this case, since you're on guided tours around the islands, You have
it's like
to.
Like an extended family.
Yeah, the guides were excellent at giving us time to photograph. They were very, very good, so we didn't feel hurried and stuff. But you just can't go to one place and camp out for hours like we do sometimes when we're out shooting. You can't do that. You have to keep moving along. By the way, the guides were really, really good. Extremely well educated, very professional. Learned a lot.
So here you are, you're out on these islands now, and
let's
talk about some of the photographic stuff that you did.
Mm-hmm.
You get out of the boat and hopefully you're not wet.
Yeah, you know, good point. I'll tell you. We're starting to get a little bit into equipment here with this next thing, but I took the D3, I took the D300, I took way too much junk. As usual, I used it all, so, you know.
Well, then you didn't take too much.
No, but I had... With the D300, I just used the 18-200. And what I did is I used that as almost like a point-and-shoot camera, you know, very nice point-and-shoot camera, but that's how I was using it, more for snapshots. Or if I really didn't want to carry around a lot of stuff or couldn't for some reason. So when we stopped at little towns, things like that, that's what I took. And on a few hikes, I took that. The D3 got used for most everything else. So, you know, probably 85% of my shots were made with the D3. And with that camera, I had my 300 f4 AFS lens. That got used a lot. That was just like the perfect Galapagos lens with that camera. And then I had my 70-200. That got used a fair amount, not as much as the 300. I had the 28-70-28 and then the 17-35. And the 17-35 got used a fair amount too. You know, that was kind of fun. So that's what I had. I had a flash also. I really didn't use that very much at all. You know, I had visions of, you know, doing some things with the better beamer and stuff, and I just didn't really need to.
Mm-hmm.
The lighting was pretty good. It, you know, we had a mix of weather down there. None of it bad, but, you know, some days we had bright sunlight, but usually we had some clouds mixed in there, and there were some days where we had the bright overcast light. And we've talked a little bit about that before.
That can be really good for certain things.
It's really nice if you're photographing
wildlife.
Exactly. It's, you know, that diffused, glowing kind of light where you don't get the burned out highlights and things like that. So I was pretty
happy. Especially on volcanic islands where a lot of times your subjects may be perched on black rocks.
And they were almost all the
like,
time.
I'm thinking about marine iguanas here.
Yeah,
which
absolutely.
Are going to always be there.
Yeah.
Then overcast is really ideal because it preserves a lot more detail.
I was happy, and of course it was a little bit cooler too. Mm-hmm. Not that the weather was ever extremely hot. It was pretty nice down there.
It was better than what we had here while you were gone.
I heard that.
It was flipping cold.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So getting back to.
I thought about that a lot though while you were gone, how cold I was.
I thought about the idea of this isn't a bad place to be, you know.
In January.
At any rate, so we were talking a little bit about the surf and getting wet and stuff like that. I had stuck my equipment in my think tank airport antidote, which is a backpack kind of thing that we've talked about before. Holds an amazing amount of stuff for its size. So that's what I took on the trip just so I could be fully loaded. And I got to tell you, the very first time that we did a landing, and it was a wet landing, you know, where you drop off into the surf, we were riding in that panga toward the shore, and I thought, I am out of my flipping mind. I had visions of falling off the raft and into the water and, you know, soaking all my new stuff.
In salt water, no less.
Oh, my God, yeah. So, fortunately, that never, ever happened. I will say, though, that one woman did lose her balance one time getting in and out of the raft. It, very easy thing, because we had some rough surf at times. And she soaked about the lower 25% of her Low Pro mini trekker bag. I don't think any of her equipment was damaged, but came awfully close. So, you know, if I were going to do it again, probably for my own sanity, I might pick up one of those Low Pro Dry Zone bags. You know, it's a waterproof.
Right. As long as the zippers are closed.
Yeah.
They'll float.
Right.
But if you don't,
like I said, I didn't have a problem. My son, who also had a backpack, you know, he was using one of those mini trekker things, didn't have a problem.
What kind of shoes were you wearing for these wet landings? I'm guessing hiking boots and socks the protocol there.
Three different things. I had a pair of Aqua shoes. You familiar with those?
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, they look like a sneaker, only they've got mesh on them.
Right. Keeps the sand and stuff out.
They work very, very well if you're starting with your feet dry and free of sand. They're absolutely super. And if you land on some places where it can be a little bit rocky and uneven on the bottom, they are just great. Because you can also hike around in them after you get on shore.
Yeah, that's what's cool about those.
So I highly recommend getting something like that if you go down there. I also had some, you know, sandals, you know, waterproof ones. Mm-hmm. Wore those a couple times. And sometimes we just went barefoot because we had some beaches that we landed on where it was just nice, soft sand. And if you can skip wearing anything and you don't have to hike around, which we did in a few places, that's the way to go.
All right. So that's what we were. That's interesting. Yeah, because footwear is always just something that's important. And the last thing you want to do is be prepared for nice hiking boots and then be soaked.
Yeah.
Because it takes forever to dry out.
Oh, especially down there. Things don't dry.
Yeah, because it's humid. You're on the equator.
They just don't.
And that's.
Yeah. But, you know, one thing to be aware of, you know, because the Galapagos are very appealing and there are a lot of different packages and stuff. The kind of thing that we were doing was exactly what we wanted and it's exactly what we would do again. But if you have physical limitations, think a little bit about it because no kidding, some of these places, we look like a bunch of Marines, you know, jumping out of the raft into the water. And when the surf got rough, there were a few people, some women in particular, that just had to be almost thrown in the raft. They actually were, honest to God. But wow. Guys, it was not a pretty sight in some respects, but it was a little bit hard. So if you've got severe physical limitations, think twice. Probably not right thing.
And I know my mother-in-law has been to the Galapagos, and when they went, they... commented that there were situations where, you know, a walking stick would have been a good thing. It just depends on the tour that you're on because there's a lot of uneven terrain. And so if you have difficulty getting around, you just need to pick the kind of tour that's
didn't see any issues, you know, severe ones once you were on the land. It was really just the landings
getting in and out,
getting back in the boat that
But then aren't there other tours that they are more geared for?
So.
They'll probably go to places where it's different.
Positive.
Given the tourist industry.
Yeah, but it's something that you might want to ask if you're concerned about that. We thought it was fun. All right. So
what kind of subjects did you take pictures of? I mean, I've seen some of your pictures here that you brought to France.
Yeah, I brought a few with me. And, you know, some of the things that we have. We'll throw a few images up on the blog page, and maybe I'll have some things on my website by the time this goes out, which is at GeoVista. It's GEO-VISTA.com. And I've only printed a small subset of images so far, but what I brought over to show Jason, including some black and whites that, you know, I did of some of the landscapes, you know, there really were some places that looked like a different planet and things like that. And obviously lots of wildlife, including the birds.
Well, this shot here that you have here, it appears to be,
just dropped a print,
a tern. Mm-hmm. It's looking like some kind of tern. I don't know which variety of tern it is.
I knew at one point, but it's a white one.
Yeah. You know, classic tern, black and white, red beak, and you've absolutely frozen it. Now, you said you did that with a D3.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, all the wildlife shots were with the D3.
And I'm just looking, here's birds in flight. Now, I've tried terns. They're hard because they don't always stop. They're fairly small.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not small birds, but they're not hawks or eagles. So when they're moving, they go fast.
Oh yeah.
And so you didn't. I mean, judging from this shot, it looks like the autofocus and everything was just bang on.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We had done some test shots and things like that in December with the D3.
Right, when we first got the cameras,
but didn't really get a sense to thrash it. And certainly I did on this trip. I'll tell you, man, the autofocus system, in my opinion, is outstanding. The way I shot with it pretty much exclusively is I had it in continuous autofocus using the button on the rear, like we've talked about before. That has enormous benefits for almost every kind of photography I can think of. And then I had it set to use 9 sensors.
Nine point dynamic.
The 9-point dynamic. And I'll tell you, it just nailed the shots. You know, this was a bird in flight shot that you're referring to, and you look at the others and they're sharp, 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 sharp. And I just didn't have any autofocus problems that I can think of on the trip.
And did you have the lock on setting on or off?
Off.
Okay. So you set it to off because you didn't have a lot of distracting background clutter where it might lock on the wrong.
No, was not a problem. And, cool. And I just didn't run into that.
Nice.
But
no,
yeah,
I think the old axiom still holds true. The fewer autofocus sensors you have active at any one time, potentially the system should be more responsive. Mm-hmm. It has fewer data points to process.
Yeah, and you know, maybe in a few months' time after we've both had more experiences with the camera, we may choose a different setting. It was a fairly conservative thing, but it worked great. So I just left it there.
Whatever works, limitations with it. No, I'm just really impressed because you don't do a lot of birds in flight shots. And
no, I don't.
And so here's one. And you did this handheld with the 300, correct?
Right.
On the D3.
Right. And the image is actually cropped slightly, and it just looks gorgeous.
Now, there's no noise in this. What ISO was this?
Oh, at least 1,000.
Jeez. And I'm looking at this.
It was actually 1,600.
Now, on this print, and I'm not kidding, on this, what's a semi-gloss paper that you've got here, Ilford paper, I think. This print has no noise, no grain, no nothing in it.
No nothing.
It looks like...
And it's cropped.
And it looks like ISO 200 or 100 from what we're used to seeing.
Right.
I'm not kidding. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's a 12 by 18 print, right? That's about...
Yeah.
Or maybe
that's
a little bit
is.
Smaller. Yeah, 12 by 18. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's freaking amazing. And here's some more.
You know, here's
iguanas.
A land iguana, or is that a marine iguana, or a
marine?
Those marine iguana that you got down at belly level with it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just amazing. And there's a little bit of grain in this, but you said you forgot to turn noise reduction off or on in post, right?
Yeah. You can see some microscopically small.
It looks like film. That's about it.
Better than that, I would say.
Yeah, it looks like a really fine-grained, like Velvia or Provia 100 kind of grain to it. And you could have cleaned it up, right? You just forgot?
Yeah, it was an early print I made.
And there's nothing wrong with this print.
I mean, I'm looking at it slightly wrong.
If this was hanging on the wall, I don't think anyone would come up to this print and say, oh gosh, gee, there's... It looks better than National Geographic.
Yeah.
I'll give it that.
Just a few other, you know, things in here. That we're talking about. Some more iguana shots.
You know, on the black lava here. And this must have been on overcast day.
Yeah.
You know, that works really well because you get the pop
ISO
of the
ISO 1600.
Colors.
And I did do that one correctly. And you can see the background is just smooth and
There's
nice.
Detail.
Yeah.
It's not like you've zapped any of the detail.
No.
It's amazingly good.
Yeah, actually, what the way I process these images, we're going to talk more about that in a sec, was using a combination of Lightroom and ACR. And what I did for sharpening when I did it correctly, and what I did for noise reduction when I did it correctly, is if I was shooting at 1600, I used a very tiny amount of luminance noise removal, a setting of 10, which is very, very light. And then I just kept it on the standard amount for the color noise removal of 25. And if I was less than 1600, I didn't even use noise reduction. The other thing was with the sharpening, which I did in Lightroom or ACR, use the masking feature. What it does is it doesn't sharpen areas where there's an absence of detail, like the background. And that's the thing that makes the difference. You know, a couple other quick shots that we're looking at, and again, we'll put these on the show notes, but one is of a heron on some lava, ISO 1000. The background is just
It looks
utterly,
like ISO 100.
Yeah.
It really does.
It almost looks better than that, right? You know, so ridiculously smooth.
Especially at this size. Looking. And this is bigger than any magazine.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is bigger than a two-page spread in National Geographic. Mm-hmm. And it looks absolutely perfect.
Yeah. And the other shots, you know, just the same way. I mean, these are both ISO 1600, no noise. Visible in the print. Nothing. Just smooth.
A yellow warbler on black lava. That's amazing.
Yeah. The colors are just great too. And that's one of the reasons why you get fooled when you're looking at these. I had my son, you know, take a look at these prints yesterday, and I just played the guess the ISO game. And for the ones at 1600, he was guessing 200. Yeah. I mean, that's the way.
And the only reason why you're guessing that is because you know that it couldn't have been 100.
Right.
Or the, you know, the camera was goes down to 200. It's like, right. Well, I know you must have been shooting faster than the minimum, right?
Yeah.
But even then.
Yeah. But the nice thing was that, you know, it enabled me to just go handheld for most everything. You know, I was shooting at, you know, very, very high shutter speeds. I was usually shooting around 5-6 or so with that 300 millimeter lens. And, you know, I was getting shutter speeds of 1500, 2500th of a second, things like that.
Way more than you need.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that brings up another point. It's when you're on a trip like this, if you don't have to pack a, and we'll talk more about travel tripod, mm-hmm. but, you know, if you can get away without a tripod, if you can get away with, you know, you're jumping in and out of a Zodiac.
Right.
I mean, who wants to be laden down with huge tripod and everything else that you got to have? You know, it can be, I mean, I did that once in Maine and I got out of this dinghy and I'm in the dinghy and you had to hand people, and I had my 500 millimeter lens and you hand people your stuff because and the surf, you know, it wasn't surf, but you know, it was a good surge there and you're trying to get on this little dock and it's pretty hairy.
Yeah.
And the less stuff that you can, you know, have to pack, I say that's the better.
Yeah. Yeah, with the lens choices and everything, you know, used with the D3, I'll tell you, a day before we left, I started getting nervous. You know, because generally what I'd read is, oh, you can get so close, you really don't need a big lens. And 300 millimeters on a 35 millimeter body or a camera like the D3 that's got that FX format is fine. But then I read a few things about people taking 500s. Fortunately, I saw some later things where they changed their opinion of that. But in the end, I just decided to risk it and go with nothing bigger than my 300 f4. And that was a good choice. It's not that I couldn't have used something longer at times, but I didn't need to. And so I was, you know, able to get very close to the animals, still get good subject isolation, as you saw from the photos.
Right.
Backgrounds are smooth and blown out. And that 300 f4, by the way, is an excellent lens. It's been a while since I've really used it much, and it is just a beautiful lens to use. But I was glad I wasn't carrying around some big 200 to 400.
Well, just all the accessories that go with it, the time, the setup time.
I would have needed a big tripod. Just because my arms would have gotten
there. Yeah, you just can't handhold that lens.
Right.
It's a little bit extreme.
Yeah. So, you know, my conclusion is the D3 and combined with those lenses was just like the perfect thing for me.
Now, if you hadn't had your D3, you could have just used a D300 with the 70 to 200 and had enough reach.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have necessarily needed that 300. Not right. that you wouldn't have wanted brought it, but
right.
It's just you would have gotten the same, more or less the same
framing. I could have definitely gone lighter. You know, that was the downside, is it's not like it was a light, compact setup, but it was a blast to use, and I really like the results. So I was pleased with it. No doubt about that.
So you did 7 days in the Galapagos, mm-hmm. and then you went back to Quito, is that mm-hmm. correct? And mm-hmm. so then you tooled around more?
Yeah, we got back to Quito, and then the next morning went up to a place called Bella Vista Cloud Forest. That's Bellavista. Bella Vista in Gringo speak.
In Gringo speak.
Yeah. And
which means beautiful view.
Yeah, it's
in Spanish.
It does. It does. And we stayed at an eco lodge there, which is really, really nice. If you do we'll put a link to it too, because it was a nice place run by very nice people. It was really cool. Way up on the hillside in this cloud forest. That one was around 2,200 meters, so right around 7,000 feet, fairly high altitude. But, ultra lush, and the clouds are just swirling around mist and rain.
Neat.
And the place that we stayed, like I said, was on a hillside, several different buildings in this compound, but they were right on the edge. So you had these, plummeting rainforest-like areas coming down, and really awesome. It had the feel of being in a Swiss Family Robinson treehouse, if you understand that reference. It was actually made of
bamboo. If you've ever been to Disneyland, then you know
it. Yeah.
I think they took it out, though, at Disneyland.
Oh,
I know. I'm just.
Sad.
I think they had to take it out to make room for one of the new rides. I think they did.
But I loved that one.
I know. It was very cool.
So if you liked that, you would love this place. It was really cool. And they had
great. And so what kind of stuff were you photographing in the cloud forest? Just everything?
Almost nothing.
Nothing? Or you were just on vacation then?
Almost nothing. I took some pictures around the compound. And
I would just think there'd be tree frogs and birds and things.
Yeah. The thing was, though, there was a lot of rain while we were there. And so, fortunately we had Gore-Tex rain parkas. And we threw waterproof ponchos over those, and we had, what Wellington boots are, rubber things. They had those for free there that you could use. And so we wore all that stuff and went out for hikes. But it was just raining so much, I just didn't really want to do it.
I can understand that.
Yeah. And it was fun just to see this stuff, but
right.
lots of really interesting plants, bats, and all sorts of birds, including toucans, and you name it. It's just very, very cool. Very cool.
Awesome.
Sometimes it's good not to do the photography.
Oh, yeah.
Just enjoy
it. And the other thing, when you're in a rainforest or cloud forest kind of situation, most of the time when you see the animals, they're not close.
Right.
You hear them more than you see them.
Right.
Realistically. And there's no light. So
yeah. I would have been fine on the light if I had had the D3.
But you'd have wanted a 600 millimeter
amazing.
Lens.
But I would have needed a big lens. Even on a D300, I would have needed a big lens.
Yeah. So
talking 500, 600 kind of thing, because they're little bitty birds for the most part, mm-hmm. not very close.
Right. So you have your binoculars.
Yeah,
just enjoy them.
Great place to go.
Very, very fun. Now, so how you said you used the D300 about 15% of the time, mm-hmm. roughly speaking. So mm-hmm. what did you find that with that, where did you tend to use that when you were in town?
Yeah.
Try not to look like a professional photographer.
Exactly. Lugging. There were times where we had a little bit of free time on some of the islands that were populated. And so we were walking through the towns and things like that. And I just didn't want to have my backpack and a big camera and
right.
stuff. So I just took the D300 and the 18-200.
That's an amazing little kit, isn't it?
It's great. It is so nice for lightweight travel and very flexible. We went to a place called the Charles Darwin Center on Santa Cruz Island, mm-hmm. and they have some of the giant tortoises there. There were some other places that we went to on that island that had them too. And, going there, I took it because that was a combination of some landscapes, including cactuses and, all sorts of interesting vegetation, plus the tortoises and just people shots, because like anyone, I took a bunch of family shots.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I used the D300 a lot too. Just a very nice general purpose camera. And so I used it there. I used it at the markets on the mainland part of Ecuador and some things like that. Certainly around Colonial Quito, that's what I took. you know, for all the same reasons. You know, you save a lot of weight and size. So
now, before we leave,
I even did some serious landscapes with that 18-200.
Oh, yeah. I saw one that looks wonderful.
Yeah, it does.
I recently purchased that lens just because of all the good things I heard about it. So I said, okay, this will be nice with now that I do have the D300. Mm-hmm. And I have to say, I haven't used it that much, but when I have used it, I have been very impressed.
Yeah.
And it really does solve for 90% of situations. It can be, it is a solution. Mm-hmm. It's a 99% solution for most situations.
Yeah. Everything in life is a compromise.
But and that's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
That one is a lot of, and so I know that my dad, for example, had a hard time justifying almost a $700 lens purchase, but he did get it and he took it to Africa recently and it just was so handy.
Mm-hmm. It's
you
not,
can just do everything with it.
You know, when I look at the images that I made with the D300 and 18-200 and compare them with the others, you know, you look really close and they're not quite as sharp, you know, but you know, you saw the prints, they look great. So,
right.
And you don't worry about it.
When you say not quite as sharp, that's in comparison to something with something that costs five times more, possibly.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, what are you really paying for?
Yeah.
It's just since we're talking about traveling, you know, mm-hmm. we've talked about travel lenses and that was one of them, but
yeah,
you know, I'm just impressed on how compact of a lens that is.
Oh yeah.
And on a D300 without a grip, that's just a great little.
Yeah. A heck of a range.
And it's still more camera than most people have.
Oh yeah. So,
you were doing some processing and you said you found a quick fix for getting better exposures with your ACR/Lightroom conversions.
Yeah, you know, it was something that was bugging the heck out of me early. And I know some other people have run into this based on comments about exposure. And it was driving me nuts early. It wasn't like things were really off, but with both the D3 and the D300, my images were just coming out a little bit too bright. And I, you know, like always, I shoot in RAW mode. And I was just surprised because I was seeing more blown highlights than I expected. And it was just strange. But, you know, I wasn't doing some really scientific thing. But, you know, I noticed you weren't seeing any issues processing your image, which you do pretty much exclusively in an X.
Right.
And then I started playing around with it a little bit, and when I had them in an X, I wasn't seeing the blown highlights.
So then the light bulb went
on. I was seeing a very
on.
Different histogram. Well, it took a little while, but fortunately, I started figuring things out. And at first I thought, well, you know, maybe my cameras are just a little bit different. Interestingly, they were consistent with each other, the D300 and D3, and similar conditions, I was getting almost exactly the same metering results.
So you could go into the camera and do the fine-tune the exposure, right?
Right, and that's what I started doing. And in fact, at one point, I dialed the D3 down by a half stop.
Wow.
Right.
I mean, I've never needed that.
But then of course,
I'm not processing
when I was using Lightroom, it seemed to be about right, and then I'd put it in an X, and they'd be dark. It's like, frustrating. And so what I ended up doing is eventually finding that the D3 worked pretty well at just minus 1/6 of a stop. Almost trivial. You could almost skip it, but that turned out to be kind of like the optimal exposure.
If you're talking about dialing in an exposure.
Yeah.
Fine tune.
Right. That's something that once you've done, you don't really see in the display. It's just
this
there.
Actually changes the metering behavior of your camera.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's one of those custom functions in there, and it's not something that you would recommend unless you know what you're doing.
No, right? I don't recommend that everyone adopt it. You can try it. See,
it
what
may
you
give
think.
You better results.
Yeah, I found that both the D3 and the D300 probably a little bit better with that. Fewer.
The 1/6 is pretty small.
It's tiny. It's really fine tuning and being obsessive, probably. The more important thing is what I found is with both ACR and Lightroom, what I need to do is, on the exposure slider, change it to minus 0.25. So minus 0.25.
Just by default in your
preset. My defaults. I do that. Everything is happy. I can look at the camera's histogram and If it shows no burned out highlights, then I don't get them in my raw processing either, which is what was happening before.
Okay.
My histogram in the camera was, it was the opposite of what you would normally think. Raw was less forgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And the images were coming out too bright. So -2.5 in conjunction with the -1.6 into the camera, things are perfect. Things are perfect.
And just for reference, I haven't dialed in any kind of exposure compensation override in either of my bodies. Now, I haven't shot with them in outdoor situations that much yet, so I may end up doing that. But I think the in-body, the in-camera exposure override, the exposure compensation, or whatever you want to, the exposure fine-tuning, I think is what mm-hmm. it's called, is just something that you have to make sure you have it to your taste before you do it, because yeah. it affects every image. You can't override that without going in and turning it off.
Yeah, and it's a very subtle thing. Mm-hmm. It just gave me a little bit more highlight protection, that's all.
Yeah.
And it worked perfectly. So
very cool.
The important thing was the adjustment in ACR and Lightroom. That made a big difference.
So the take-home message.
When I look at the images, you know, out of the camera, if you were shooting JPEGs, out of Lightroom and NX, they look the same.
You've got a level playing field now.
And I can use the histogram in the camera to accurately predict, or at least more accurately predict what's going on.
So that's good to know for our Lightroom and ACR users, yeah. which I'm sure is a lot of people.
Yeah, give it a try.
That
see
might
what
solve
think.
your blown highlights with D3s and D3s.
Yeah, there's just something a little bit dorky with the tone curves there.
Okay.
Hopefully now that I've got all my images fixed, they don't change it, which is certainly possible.
You never know.
It is a little bit off, I think. So, all right, one last thing to wrap it up, or almost one last thing, tripod.
Right. So you've used this Gitzo GT1550T,
mm-hmm.
and we should point out a goof from last time, which is we had the wrong spec, weight load rating of this tripod is technically 2 kilograms or about 4.4 pounds.
Right.
Yeah, we were looking routinely at exceeded that.
I did. Sometimes it's good not to know that.
But we looked it up and we got a note in the podcast feedback forum from one of our listeners mm-hmm. and said, "Hey, you guys got that wrong." And so we admit it. We made a mistake.
Yeah. Actually, the website we looked at was wrong.
So. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. But that's our excuse. We'll stick.
But
it was
sure
good to not know
it.
That because, you know,
right.
this little sucker actually worked pretty well. The way I used it frequently when I wasn't going handheld was, you know, a thing that's always true with wildlife, especially smaller wildlife, is your shots are never good if you're standing way the heck up or if you have your tripod at eye level and then you're pointing down at
right.
something on the ground.
You want to be at eye level with those
you
animals.
You really do. You really do. And sometimes I wasn't able to do that and the shots weren't good. The ones that worked were the ones I got where I got down on the ground at eye level. It's just a psychological thing, but it is very, very real. So given that, the way I was using this tripod was with maybe just one segment extended.
The very first segment.
And not even that, always, because I was sitting on the ground, had the tripod tucked up mm-hmm. against me, and then I actually had a D3 with a 300 F4 and sometimes a 1.4 teleconverter on it, too.
And it was no problem.
No problem.
Great.
No problem. This thing is rigid, and it works well. I actually did some experimentation with it extended all the way, and just pressing down very lightly, tripod, it was fine too. So you just have to be careful. The main thing that you have to be a little bit savvy about it is a very lightweight tripod. So if you've got something heavy on it, be careful.
Right,
hang the strap around your neck.
Right, it could blow over.
Oh, you could just bump it and it could go over. So, but it's a wonderful little tripod. It is so compact. I had it in my carry-on bag and I had the tripod head on it and it still left lots of space, not even going diagonally.
That's great.
It really is very clever.
Oh, geez, I'm gonna have to just save up some more money to get
one. I might have to also,
because that looks like a really nice little rig there.
Yeah, and unfortunately it has to go back.
I hate that
this week. It yeah, that's a shame.
But we again want to thank the nice folks at Bogan for letting us try this.
Right, it was a lot of fun.
And now if you're going to you know, there's two flavors of this tripod before I move on to the next small mini topic, which would be ball heads for these tripods.
Right.
But just so if you're looking up in the catalog, the one that Rick used and what we've been able to play with a little bit is the 1550T.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a five section tripod. So it's extends up to 146 centimeters with the center column, and it comes with a small ball head.
Yeah,
a little Gitzo ball head.
Mm-hmm.
There's another variant of this, which is a four section, the GT1540T, and it doesn't extend out quite as high. It doesn't come with the little ball head. But it has a load capacity of 4.5 kilograms.
Double.
So almost 10 pounds.
Yeah.
That's intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
Because what you were describing is you were rarely using it fully extended.
Right.
So depending on your shooting style. Now, also, I would imagine it's a little bit less expensive when you don't buy the ball head on it, too.
Yep.
Of course, you save money there. You'll spend it elsewhere. So that's what we want to talk about the next.
Yeah.
The
so
next
just thing. To reinforce that topic, if I were getting one, and I am actually thinking about it because I thought it was such a cool thing to have, so handy. I think I might get the 1540, just because I'd want to use a different ball head, you know, one that was Arca Swiss compatible, and you know, I don't think I'll extend it fully all the way anyway, and it's not appreciably longer.
It folds down to slightly longer. It's just a few centimeters longer.
Yeah.
No, it's 14 versus 15 or something inches.
Yeah.
Either way, they're very tiny.
Right.
But apparently very useful.
Yeah. So I was pleased.
It almost is that holy grail of the small, light, yet sturdy tripod.
Mm-hmm. as long as you're realistic about how you're using it.
Right. You have to be careful.
Right. Now, ball heads.
Yeah, what kind of ball head do you have on there right now? I noticed that that's...
I mentioned it in our previous podcast. I was able to get one of the Markins Q3 ball heads, which is the smallest Markins ball head, and it is a beaut. I experimented with a few other things because, you know, as everyone knows, I've got way too much junk at home. So I tried a few other things, too. I have this little tiny, really right stuff ball head, a BH25 that I've used on tabletop tripods. And it works, but it's nowhere in the same class as the Markins head. The Markins head is bigger.
Right.
But it's the most compact that I know of all the professional ball heads. And the thing that really makes it much nicer to use is it has a tension control. The RRS one does not. And the controls are just much easier to manipulate. I found the RRS one is just too small.
Mm-hmm.
My fingers were forever getting caught up in the release.
And I can imagine without a tension control, if you got any kind of heavy, like a D300 even.
But I was pushing things too.
You know, you're going to have a lot of load on that. But that looks like the smallest ball head you could possibly get that has an Arca Swiss plate on it.
Yeah, I think it is.
That RRS BH25.
Right. But the Markins Q3 is just beautiful.
Yeah, it looks really nice.
And similar to their other heads, the tension control is just a thing of beauty. You get it adjusted right, and then you can just move even a heavy load like the D3 and the 300 around without locking it fully, and it'll stay there.
That's a very good feature.
And the controls are so much nicer to use because they're slightly bigger size.
And this has a true pan base.
Yeah.
Whereas doesn't look like the RRS has a panning base, does it?
It does, but the problem is it's only got one lever for everything.
Okay.
So when you unlock it, everything is moving around on you. And it gets tough with a heavier load.
Right.
I really was pushing things when I tried it.
But great for a small camera or a point-and-shoot camera.
Yeah, it'd be fine for that. But the Q3 Traveler tripod, in my opinion, is the hot ticket. That's the way it goes. To go in. And at least with this 1550, I haven't tried the 1540 tripod.
You can fold it up
and everything still fits. You can make that
right,
work.
It's small enough.
So the legs aren't all splayed out with this tripod head on there. You just have to line it up correctly so the buttons aren't poking into the legs and everything's fine. We'll throw up a picture of that too on the website.
Very nice.
If you go bigger than that, like I had a Kirk BH3 thing that I've owned for several years, that's just a whole lot bigger and it's too big for this tripod and it's nowhere as smooth. So again, I think the Q3 is quite awesome in that capacity.
That's the one to get.
Mm-hmm.
And you can buy those Q3s on the Nikonian's Pro Shop, right?
Yep. PhotoProShop.com. Unfortunately, at this moment, you can't get the Traveler tripod, but I've mentioned it to the staff, and we may try adding that.
And I'm sure that
cool. That's how
that
other
we carry
stuff,
other Bogan and Gitzo right. tripods.
Very
I'm sure
frankly, that's how a lot of stuff got in the shop, right?
Right.
You know, either we or others found something they really liked and added it to the shop because we thought it was cool.
But that Q3, which is the nickname, that's the Emil ball head.
Right.
Very nice. I had not seen one prior to this. That's, it just looks like a scaled down version of a full on pro mm-hmm. Markins
yeah.
ball head.
Yeah,
that's
same
great.
Beautiful finish and everything. So very, very nice.
So the money that you save there, you'd put it back into the ball head.
Yeah.
And then some.
Yeah. But you'll like it.
But you will like it.
Yeah.
Okay. So,
and by the way, that ball head is a good choice with slightly larger tripods too. Like the, well, I can't remember the new names. What I was thinking about were the Gitzo 1228, 1227.
Yeah, you could use it on that.
Oh yeah.
It would be fine.
Yeah. I actually had it on mine the other day and it works great.
It's small, but it's not dinky.
Mm-mm. And it's got very good load capacity.
Excellent.
Okay.
Well, it seems like it's about that time for us to do our photo prescription.
And then shut up.
And then shut up for yep. a while.
You're going to do this one, right?
Yeah, and this is sort of a it's more of a, sort of less of a prescription and more of a how-to and a clarification because with the D300s and the D3s, more people, we've talked a lot about auto ISO.
Mm-hmm.
And one question that keeps cropping up is, does auto ISO work with my flash? And there seems to be a mixed bag of responses out there in the various internet land. And mm-hmm. so I've played around with it. And the answer is auto ISO does work with a flash like an SB800, but it doesn't work in the same way that you would think of it working. When you don't have the flash attached, here's what happens with auto ISO. And if you use a flash, when you put the flash on and you turn it on and you have auto ISO enabled, the first thing you're going to see is that the ISO is going to on your camera is going to drop to the lowest value in which it's set, even if the ambient light levels are low. Maybe you have a meter reading where it was using, let's say you just set your camera up 250th of a second at f/5.6 and you're indoors in a room where it says, well, to do that, you need ISO, 3200. Mm-hmm. Let's just make up a number. You put the flash on, you turn on, the next thing you know is you see that the ISO goes down to 200.
Assuming you've set that as your base.
If that's right. your base, right.
right.
And by default, that would usually be your base. So then this gets everyone scratching their heads and say, well, then obviously auto ISO doesn't work with my flash. And that is sort of true, but it's not true. What happens is that the way the camera utilizes auto ISO with a flash is that it takes into consideration the output of the flash and the background, the distance to your subject and all this other good mm-hmm. stuff. So I'm assuming you're using D or G type lenses, and an SB800 kind of camera, or kind of flash. So it can calculate all that distance information. If there's enough light if the flash can put out enough light to illuminate your background properly in the conditions that you have, it'll use the lowest ISO possible. As soon as conditions get too dim for the flash to illuminate properly, the ISO will kick up, but you won't notice it in the viewfinder. The way you can check to see that it works is by when you're going in your image playback review, mm-hmm. check through the EXIF data and you'll see that the ISO value is recorded in red and it'll say a value other than 200. It might say 640. It might say 1200, whatever, but it'll be in red and that's that red ISO value is there to tell you that this was something chosen using auto ISO mode. Mm-hmm. It does it in red even when you don't have the flash attached, but that's a good way of knowing what it was doing. It doesn't give you that indication in the viewfinder of the ISO that was chosen. You'll see it on your EXIF later.
Mm-hmm.
So the way I proved it to myself was by shutting off all the lights down in the basement and going down there and setting some ridiculous, I put my flash into FP sync mode, set it to 1/1000th of a second at f/5.6 and said, all right, you focus on something 20 feet away and take a picture. And sure enough, it had kicked up to ISO 2000 or something like that, even with the flash attached.
Okay.
So the good news is that it works. The important thing is that you understand how it works, because this is something that you're not going to be able to use To shoot high ISO with balanced fill flash, for example.
Yeah, and I would suspect the reason it's not showing it in the viewfinder is it has to send out those pulses in advance of the real flash exposure to check that background and whether or not it can be illuminated.
Right. The monitor pre-flashes are going to
dictate that. So given that, you know, I can understand that.
So it will read out the lowest ISO in your viewfinder, but if you're using it, it'll work. And if you want to use a higher ISO with the flash, just set the base ISO higher. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times I do that anyway where I'm indoors. I've found that I've really been playing around with flash and the D3 lately just for fill flash. And indoors, hey, shoot at 800, and then you can do bounce and fill, and you don't get weird shadows, and the flash has plenty of output for that, and things just look natural. Yeah. It's amazingly good, actually.
Well,
it's pretty fun.
Again,
to revisit all of our topics.
1,000 is the low ISO setting now.
Yeah.
For D3.
And, you know, it just before we leave, it just makes me think that we're going to have to go back through all of our old topics and put new D3 caveats on there and say, well, that was before. That
Never
was the
mind.
Old days. And now if you have a D3 or a D300 even, to a certain extent, you can, you know, we don't talk about the D300 enough, but it really is good too.
Oh God, yeah.
You know, and so both of those. So that's sort of our tip. It's just that, yes, it does work. Here's how it works. You can use auto ISO with flash, but it doesn't behave in the same way as it does without the flash. So,
yep.
So it's there and it's an option.
I'll have to try it.
Yeah.
One very last thing.
Yeah, a little announcement.
Really, we will shut up for sure and sign off is we're going to be teaching at least one workshop or a portion of a workshop and potentially two
through the Nikonians Academy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I guess we'll have to throw yet another web link in the show notes. We're gonna have a bunch this time. At any rate, there's going to be a workshop in San Francisco, April 10th through 14th. And we'll probably be doing some things on the 13th and 14th related to, digital workflow.
The 10th through the 13th, but yeah.
NX, you know, things like
Capture that. NX, workflow, Photoshop, mm-hmm. workflow, NX, workflow, all the stuff that we've talked about before,
mm-hmm.
and maybe some more things.
Yeah. So if you're interested in something like that, it's a very thorough workshop. It's sponsored by HP. I think they'll have workstations there, printers, and the topics
toys.
Cover just a extraordinary amount of information. If you go to this thing, you're going to learn a lot.
It's a 4-day workshop. We'll only be there for some of those days.
Yeah. Mike Hagan will be teaching.
Right. And he's excellent.
Yeah. He really is.
Give him
really
a
nice
two
guy.
Thumbs up. And if you want to find that link, like I said, I'll put it on the show notes page. But if you go to the Nikonians.org main page,
mm-hmm.
click the link that says workshops.
Right.
And it'll take you to there. It's like the advanced workflow,
digital
something.
Yeah.
Or other. But you'll see it.
Yeah. And there's a chance that we may do one in Dallas too, the same thing in June. That's just not a certainty yet.
So got to check my travel.
We'll know soon.
Because you know how it is. New baby at home.
Kitchen pass.
<That's right.
laughs> All right. Now we'll shut up.
Okay. Thanks for joining us again. We'll see you all in another 2 weeks. Happy shooting.
All right. Bye-bye.